we will have today a seminar by Hermann Nicolai. That's the last seminar of the course. Well, Hermann has been one of the very first to push the idea that E10 should play an important role in not only in supergravity, which was in a sense the original context, but more recently also to understand the structure of the spectrum of particles. And for that reason, I think it was a good idea to close the series of seminars with a seminar by Hermann. And he will talk about E10 and K of E10 and the role in various areas of physics, fundamental physics. So Hermann, as I said, I will repeat because not everyone was here. Hermann will pause once in a while for questions. So wait for appropriate times to raise the questions, and I will have to be here, the interface, since questions cannot be heard by the speaker, and I have to repeat them. Okay, thank you. So please go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Marc, for the introduction and for the invitation to Collège de France to give this lecture. Before I start, I would also like to send over my congratulations on the performance of the French team last evening. That was really impressive. I will talk about work I've been doing over the last few years, with Thibault, Damour, Marc Hainaut, Axel Kleinschmidt, and most more recently with Christoph Meissner from Warsaw University. And this is meant to be a sort of more global view of what we're really after with these all these efforts. And as you see, it's also a question about searching for a new paradigm of fundamental physics. And my starting point is therefore not considerations about duality symmetries and so on in supergravity. No, why isn't this working? No, okay. But I would like to start out with this diagram. I'm sure you've all seen it. After more than 10 years of running, the LHC results have been out. And what you see here is, well, essentially exclusion limits on all kinds of proposals of for beyond the standard model physics. So indeed, in these diagrams, you see no hints whatsoever of a new physics. And I should say that more recently, there's been a little bit of discussion about G-2 for the muon, but that is too uncertain to really proceed on. So that's one point, but equally important, looking at this table, looking at the results, it seems like there's no obstacle towards taking the standard model up to the Planck scale more or less as is. And this, at least a hint that this might not be totally wrong, comes from looking at the RG evolutions of the standard model couplings. Because with the measured values that were actually measured now at LHC to rather good precision, it seems like when you evolve these couplings up to the Planck scale, there are no Landau poles and no instabilities of effective potential. Well, there's a little bit of something around indicating a small instability of the scalar potential, but this is something that can be taken care of relatively easily. So the conclusion from these results is the standard model could survive more or less as is all the way to the Planck scale. And to me, this is one of the important outcomes of this LHC experiment. It doesn't indicate any need, if you just look at the experimental results, for going beyond the standard model in any drastic way. So what are we going to say in view of these results? The leading contender for unified theory is string theory. So the question is, of course, what has string theory to say about this situation after the LHC results have come out? Now, it's been known for a long time that string theory admits a very large number of vacua. So here's a nice review for this by Bert Schellekens, who was already involved early on in the early days of string theory in developing this idea. And more recently, the big number they already proposed back then has gone up to 10 to the 272,000 vacua. And it could well be more than that. In fact, it could even be infinitely many. And these come typically with gauge groups like this one, which you see here. This I just took from this paper by Taylor and Wang. Now, this is a huge set of possibilities, and it's of course, you know, very big groups. And it seems like general constraints that people have been developing over the past few years under the name of swampland program do not substantially curtail this proliferation. And another feature here is that most of string phenomenology is predicated on the assumption of low energy supersymmetry. And most actual models you see on the market that are being discussed, they're usually some extension of the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model, the MSSM. There's very little on non-supersymmetric vacua. So it's not even known whether the standard model as is, by which I mean just the non-supersymmetric version of it, is contained in this set. Well, here I quote Der Spiegel, which is a German weekly magazine, which wrote a whole long article about this and about the question whether we live in a universe that shouldn't exist. Now, faced with this, of course, there are various possibilities. One is that, in fact, the vacuum that we see, the physics we see, is somewhere hidden in this huge set of vacua. And this would actually amount to a multiverse interpretation of string theory. Or it could also be that to link string theory to the real world, one has to look for completely different and better schemes. This I would find more appealing possibility. Now, there's something else which I want to show you here, which is very old. It hasn't received much attention. This goes back to the early days of N=8 supergravity. And back in the early 80s, there were several attempts to link N=8 supergravity to standard model phenomenology, all of which quickly failed, were shown to fail. And the one you see here is actually the last attempt. And it was put forward by Murray Gell-Mann in 1983. And he describes this as a last ditch attempt to salvage the haplon interpretation of N=8 supergravity. And he made a rather simple observation, namely, N=8 supergravity has 56 spin 1/2 fermions. It has 8 gravitinos. Now you want to get rid of these gravitinos, you make them massive. That means you have to absorb, out of the 56, you have to absorb 8 Goldsteinos, which leaves you with 48 spin 1/2 fermions, which is exactly the right number in 3 generations, including right-handed neutrinos or left-handed antineutrinos. And then he went even further and made the following observation. He said that, the gauge theory has a gauge group SO8 that contains SU3 cross U1. Now, your first idea might be that this is SU3 color times U1 electromagnetism, which is the unbroken symmetry down to the lowest energies, but that doesn't work. This is something he had already considered before. But then he had this very strange idea of identifying the supergravity SU3 with the diagonal subgroup of SU3 color and a hypothetical family symmetry SU3. And this is what you see here. And he said we should identify this SU3 of supergravity with the diagonal subgroup of SU3 color and SU3 family. And then this is what you get. And this is exactly what you also get from n equals 8 supergravity. As for the charges, what you see in the left column, this is actually what you get from supergravity, also doesn't fit. But here I've written the actual electric charges of the various particles. And then Galman noticed that you could fix this mismatch by introducing a spurion charge equal to 1/6. And it has to alternate in a certain way that's associated with the assignments of the family group. And we were, of course, excited at the time, and we're even more excited when we realized with Nick Warner back in 1985 that this scheme is actually realized at the SU3 Grossi 1 stationary point of a gauged n equals 8 supergravity. So we were sort of hyper excited for a couple of days and tried to fix this, but we just could not get this to work. So while I keep talking about this because I find it kind of tantalizing, but the reaction of most people would be, well, it's nice numerology, but it really shows that in the end, it just doesn't work. And therefore we have to discard n equals 8 supergravity in our attempt to unify the fundamental interactions. I want to take a slightly different a point of view on this, as you will see in the lecture as it evolves. I don't quarrel with the fact that n equals 8 supergravity doesn't give you the right thing, but I would like to take this as a hint of something else, whatever it is, that comes beyond supergravity. And here you have some indication, experimental indication, if you like, that something like this is needed beyond n equals 8 supergravity. Just like when it comes to UV finiteness of the theory, there's evidence that you may have to go all the way to string theory in order to get a finite theory of quantum gravity. So in this talk, I want to sketch some ideas in this direction, but this is by far not a finalized proposal because you will see that the gaps in our knowledge are still too big. But I simply want to point out and somehow explain why I think this seems to indicate that the way the standard model gets linked to Planck scale unified theory of quantum gravity may work in ways completely different from currently popular ideas. And this is the idea about, or this point about paradigm, because the current paradigm, and that's also completely incorporated into string theories, you just make symmetries bigger. Say if you go to GOTS, you introduce supersymmetry and thereby you enlarge the number of particles in enormously in some cases, and also the number of couplings. And what I want to emphasize is that this may not be the right way to approach the problem. Now, this is not about, you know, discarding notions of symmetry, but it's rather, the idea is rather, as you will see, that yes, we must go to bigger symmetries, but then we must somehow go beyond the ideas that have been used so far to implement symmetry in fundamental physics and unification. So this proposal makes use of several ingredients, namely BKL type and Eliezer cosmological singularities. There's something called the E10 over K10 sigma model, which is an attempt to actually formulate M theory rather than drawing pictures and big blobs with cusps at the end, but actually formulate a mathematical model of M theory with emergent space time and matter degrees of freedom. So in some sense, in analyzing the fermionic sector, I want to go beyond n equals 8 supergravity, but in some sense want to stay close to it. So the main goal is to find some way to link all these beautiful mathematics in some way to the real world. So maybe this is a good point to stop if there are already some questions at this point. Mark? Okay, good. So let's continue. So as I said, BKL is part of the essential piece of the picture. And what you see here is the space-time diagram of a cosmological space-time, which is relevant for the BKL analysis, but it's also relevant for inflationary cosmology, as you probably know. So what you see here is cosmological space-time, world lines of stationary observers, and then there's this so-called horizon problem, which means that as you approach the initial singularity, there will be causal decoupling between the spatial points. And you may notice that I've already here marked a region, which is the Planck regime, which is not probably not covered by the classical description, because we all expect that when you get into the Planck regime, then some other theory has to take over. And of course, this effort is, well, it's in part devoted to understanding what this theory might be. So according to BKL, you have this decoupling of spatial points, which can be formalized into the statement that spatial gradients can be neglected in comparison to time derivatives as you approach the hypersurface t equals zero. Now, the way I want to interpret this is by saying that what this indicates that what you have at the singularity is effectively a reduction to one-dimensional system, or rather to continuous superpositions of such one-dimensional systems. This idea is not as outlandish as it may seem, that there's some one-dimensionalness at the singularity, because if one thinks about cosmological solutions of Einstein's equations, you can think of this as a one-dimensional motion or in some dynamical system, namely a one-dimensional motion of a point particle that moves in the moduli space, not ordinary space-time, but moduli space of D geometries. So that is each point in this moduli space describes a whole spatial geometry. And this moduli space is simply a space of Riemann metrics, spatial metrics divided by spatial diffeomorphisms. This is what underlies, this analysis is something that underlies a canonical quantization approaches to quantum gravity, because they would simply say that we take this moduli space or configuration space, and then we simply quantize on that space, just like Schrödinger equation quantizes the motion of a classical point particle. And this is what leads to the so-called Wheeler-DeWitt equation, with a wave function or wave functional that lives on this moduli space. Now we're interested in unification of space-time, matter, and everything. One way to say this is that M should incorporate matter degrees of freedom in a natural manner. Not simply like the canonical quantizers do, they simply quantize Einstein gravity, and once they've solved that problem or think they have to solve the problem, then they simply append matter as some kind of accessory that can be chosen at your convenience. So the question is, can we understand this moduli space and quote unquote simplify in a very advanced sense by means of embedding into some other space that, and the idea is it's a group theoretical coset space of the type that we encounter in supergravity, namely some group divided by its maximal compact subgroup. And the main conjecture is that this group is E10 and the maximal compact subgroup is something I will get to. You notice that this in some sense fits with the original conjecture of Bernard Julliard back in 1982, that there should, this is E10 is the symmetry that should appear in the dimensional reduction to one dimension. But of course, it's not quite the same, because if you simply take 11-dimensional supergravity and reduce it to one dimension, you get a very simple mechanical system. And you will not see, only see a tiny part of this severely mutilated part of the E10 symmetry. So let's take a closer look at the Hamiltonian constraint. So here, this is what you find in every textbook on gravity, canonical gravity and quantum gravity. So the Hamiltonian constraint has a kinetic piece where the capital pi's are the momenta canonically conjugate to the metric, to the spatial components of the metric written here. And then there's this prefactor, which is the famous de Witt metric. And already at this point, I would emphasize that this metric, the de Witt metric, is famously indefinite. So when you reduce it appropriately, it's like a Klein-Gordon operator, and it's not like an elliptic Laplacian operator. And then there's a potential contribution, there may be matter contributions and so on. So this is very complicated, but there's a definite simplification that takes place in the BKL limit. Namely, this is seen by reducing to one spatial point and restricting the spatial metric to diagonal form like this. And then you rewrite this Hamiltonian, and then the kinetic term simplifies with a metric, GMN, that follows out of this de Witt metric by appropriate restrictions. And then all the rest you lump into an effective potential, and you can think of it like being, it's being obtained, or that it is obtained by quote unquote integrating out whatever else is here on the right hand side. Now this is still an extremely complicated expression, but there's a radical simplification as you approach the singularity, because it can be shown that these potential is a sum of toda-like potentials. And in the near singularity limit, these toda potentials become infinitely sharp. So in fact, you now end up with at the singularity, very simple potential, which simply consists of a superposition of walls of certain linear forms, WA, or rather the leading ones. So these are still the betas, so it's linear in the betas, and then you have various wall forms, and they depend on whatever appears here on the right-hand side. They constrain the motion in such a way that you have can describe the system in terms of a billiard system, where this point particle that moves in this beta space just bounces around in a kind of wedge in this beta space. Now comes the important step, because now I want to show you how this connects to the groups, and particularly to the groups that Mark and Axel were talking about. I assume that Mark has told you about this, and also last week we heard from Axel. And the steps are as follows. You identify the space of diagonal degrees of freedom, the betas, with the Cartan subalgebra of a certain Lie algebra. And furthermore, you identify the de Witt metric restricted to this beta space with the Cartan Keeling metric of this algebra. And again, the important feature is that this Cartan Keeling metric is indefinite, and the indefinite is inherited from the de Witt metric. And then it turns out, as was shown a beautiful letter by Marc and Thibault, that the leading wall forms can be associated with the simple roots of some indefinite Kac-Moody algebra. In this way, you simply take these wall forms and you contract them with the de Witt metric, and then you just end up with this Cartan matrix. And there are many examples where this appears. For example, Einstein gravity in four dimensions leads to something called AE3. Some call it the Feingold-Frenkel algebra. And for the maximal theory, you get E10. And then there's a nice mathematical characterization of, for example, the BKL chaos in terms of properties of this indefinite Kac-Moody algebra. And one other thing, because we're now getting into E10, one surprising property, perhaps, that has no analog in finite dimensional Lie algebra theory, is that E10 is the maximal rank such algebra, which goes with maximally extended supergravity. And this algebra contains all simply laced hyperbolic Kac-Moody algebras. So what is E10? So here I can be quick because Axel already explained it to you. It's Lie algebra group associated with a certain Dynkin diagram, which has this form. And given this Dynkin diagram, there's a systematic procedure. It's called Chevalier-Serre presentation, where it shows you how the algebra is built from basic building blocks and SL2 associated with each node. And then you simply write down a few defining relations. They're written here. E10 is the free Lie algebra that's generated by these SL2s, by commuting them in all possible ways, modulo the Jacobi identity. But the difficult part is now you also have to divide out the Serre relations, and that's what makes the problem almost unsolvable. And the important feature is that the indefiniteness of the Lie algebra implies what's called exponential growth. So that means if you stop here, it's E8, finite dimensional. If it stops here, it's affine. It's infinite dimensional, but still manageably infinite dimensional. But once you add this extra node, it becomes unmanageable, at least until now. Well, E10 contains all simply laced hyperbolic Kac-Moody algebras, but it also contains many of the duality symmetries that we have encountered in studies of M theory. So here's one way to see this. This is again something that was shown by Axel. Simply, if you analyze the algebra by restricting to a subalgebra obtained by deleting one node from the Dynkin diagram, then you can get different subalgebras, and they're given here. And then they are clearly associated with these maximally supersymmetric supergravities, and also n equals 8 supergravity. So it looks like it provides a good framework for unifying duality symmetries, the dualities that have been encountered in supergravity and superstring theory. So where are we now with this? Well, there are tantalizing hints, but also extremely difficult questions. So one thing you can do, has been shown the past few years, that one recovers all the bosonic multiplets, dynamics of maximal supergravities by appropriately slicing E10, which is really like what you want for M theory, depending on how you look at it. Out comes one of these cusps of the M theory blob that's usually shown in popular string talks. However, and this is where the difficulties really show up. First of all, that even after 50 years, there's no concrete realization of the Kac-Moody algebra. That's mainly due to the exponential growth. We've been trying to exhibit something like emergence of space-time, but this is far from resolved. We just have the first steps, but it remains a huge challenge to really work out how this works. In particular, it means understanding all these higher level representations that you get when you decompose E10. You have no idea what their physical significance is. And finally, of course, that's as a far goal, very far in the future, how to embed and UV complete standard model. So these are difficult questions that will not be resolved by the next string conference, or I guess not even a string conference in 10 years, although this would be very nice. So we've now moved, we'll now move to something else. Just, you know, we're trying to make progress wherever we see an opportunity. And this now concerns the inclusion, incorporation of fermions, which I think, and I will try to convince you that this is really one key thing to understand. It may actually also understand much better what E10 is all about. Now, important here, it's fermions are not simply described by some super extension of E10. For the simple reason, first of all, there is no super extension. Secondly, we know from supergravity that the fermions are described by the maximal subgroup of the global duality group, as evidenced by two examples here, n equals 8 supergravity in four dimensions and in maximal supergravity in three dimensions. This is where these are double-valued representations of the fermions, and they're definitely not liftable to n representations. This is important because you might say, well, if you understand E10, just take some E10 representation, decompose it under this subgroup, and then you have a representation. Yes, that's true. But we, of course, those are not the ones that we're interested in. We're interested in fermionic representations, double-valued ones, and those you can just cannot obtain by decomposing EN representations. And all of this we expect to be true, remain true for KE10. So what is KE10? Now, this is essentially a repeat of what I said about E10. Again, you have a sort of presentation for this, which is not very different from the Chevalier-Serre presentation. And this definition is entirely analogous to the one that allows you to pass from SLN, say, to its maximal compact subgroup SON. Namely, you look at a certain fixed point algebra where omega is some involution, meaning it squares to one. So the maximal compact subgroup is simply defined to be the fixed point algebra with regard to the Chevalier involution, which you see here. It's very simple. And the invariance property, of course, of this involution is very important because this is what allows you to extend the involution to all elements of the algebra, because they can all be written as multiple commutators. So you simply have to work your way backwards until you just get the omega of the fundamental generators. So if you substitute the Chevalier-Serre basis, like here, so this is the one element combination that's invariant under omega, you can deduce from the Chevalier-Serre presentation, you can also deduce these relations, which I already saw in Axel's lecture. So they look very similar to the Chevalier-Serre presentation, except that this is now inhomogeneous. And this has to do with the fact that you now get cross commutators between E's and F's and H's, and so you eliminate some. And then in simple cases, if you have the E10 Dinkin diagram with at most one node between, as one link between two nodes, then this is the relations that you have to solve. It looks fairly simple. And actually this was already considered by Berman back in 1989, who also proved some theorems. And it simply means that once you find realization of these Berman relations or Berman-Serre relations, then you have a representation. So this involutory subalgebra is, well, before I said it's like E minus F, and in terms of, you know, if you take the generators of E10, label them by their roots and by their multiplicities, then basically the generators of K10 are made up of the antisymmetric combinations. That doesn't look like a big deal for finite dimensional exceptional groups. It will just give some other group in the list of, in the classification of finite dimensional algebras. But when you go infinite dimensional, this is radically different. It's a very strange beast because, first of all, it is not a Kac-Moody algebra. And one way to see this is that it does not admit a triangular decomposition, which is a basic feature of standard Kac-Moody. It has finite dimensional unfaithful representations, again, something that you don't see for ordinary Kac-Moody algebras. And because it has such finite dimensional unfaithful representations, KE10 is not simple. It's non-simple in a very complicated way. And here already, let me say, the not simple means it has non-trivial ideals. And the way this is done, you take any unfaithful representation, and then you look at the generators in KE10, which annihilate all vectors of the representation, and they form an ideal, as you can easily show. Now, for find for the known examples, which I'm going to discuss, has a finite these ideals have finite codimension. And that's another thing that is different from the finite dimensional case, that this orthogonal complement is not a subalgebra. This is again related to certain subtleties. Last Wednesday, we heard about subalgebras of loop algebras where you fix one point. And then you see when you want to do the orthogonal complement, you have to do like a delta function, and delta functions cannot be multiplied. And this is something that you can actually verify, certainly for K of E9, very explicitly, that this thing is spanned by non-convergent formal sums. So it's like, you know, sum 1, 1, 1, 1. So that means that it's difficult to get to these representations. Maybe there are questions at this point. So let me keep going. So this not being a Kac-Moody algebra, we cannot, there are no tools for constructing representations, like highest and lowest weight representations. So this was essentially done by trial and error. And it turned out this is obtained simply by taking the fermions of maximal supergravity, namely, what fermions are there? Well, there's the Suzy parameter, epsilon, the 32-component spinner, and there's the gravitino, which is a vector spinner in 11 dimensions. And we will mostly always adopt the Coulomb gauge, so the psi zero is not zero, but some linear combination of the other components of the gravitino. And then this is, of course, just the SO10 rotation. There's nothing unusual about it. But you can extend it by certain operations that you simply read off from the supersymmetry transformation rules. And of course, it's not completely obvious how to do this, and it took us a while to figure this out. But anyway, for the spin 3/2, you get this. And one way to now to check that it's a true representation is you just check the Bermann-Serre relations. Now here it's kind of easy. This is easily done for the gamma matrices. Here it's a little more work. Now I would like to emphasize that these are really double-valued representations, because one can check that if you take a real root and rotate the fermion by 2 pi, you will get a factor of -1, as you would expect for a fermion. So these fermions can be consistently coupled to the bosonic model that was developed already some time ago. And more elegantly, with appropriate truncations and all the assumptions that also went into the bosonic analysis, it turns out that the 11-dimensional Rita-Schwinger equation can be recast in a different form, namely like a Dirac equation, but with a connection that belongs to KE10. So it's like a KE10 covariant Dirac equation, or rather the beginning, I should say. You know, all of this only goes up to a certain level, and then it sort of diverges. Well, Axel and I spent some time worrying about, you know, it's nice to have these examples from supergravity, but is that it? Or are there other examples? And as I said, they're difficult to find. But with some guesswork, we found two more. which we called spin 5/2 and spin 7/2. Of course, has nothing to do with real spin 5/2 and real spin 7/2. It's just the name, and maybe not even the best name, but anyway. And I just show you this. I will not explain it in any detail, but this links up to Axel's lecture, and this is something he did not show. He only showed 5/2. I just showed you the most complicated example we have. There's a certain expression, and when you substitute the simple roots of E10, you can check that these expressions, for if you substitute the simple roots, do satisfy the Bermann-Serre relations. So they provide a non-trivial representation, which is already much, much bigger than the Gravitino. It has some 7,000 something components. So the conjecture is that there exists an infinite tower of ever increasing finite dimensional fermionic representations that capture more and more of KE10 while remaining infinitely degenerate. So this, for example, here already allows you to probe some of the imaginary root spaces. This is where the complications lie with these indefinite Gatz-Mudi algebras. So you have a faithful representation on certain roots, not very many, but imaginary roots, meaning roots that square to negative numbers. There's also something about the associated quotients. There's another thing that was mentioned in Axel's lecture. And we think that what we found here is the beginnings of a vast generalization of the so-called generalized holonomy groups. There's been a lot of work on generalized holonomies, where you take the right-hand side of the Gravitino variation, and you combine the spin connection with whatever flux is and try to reinterpret this as some kind of connection, and then you get a certain finite dimensional group. But as Axel said, there are problems with this because these people would not know how to generalize that action to the Gravitino. Whereas here, this is completely different. We say that the real holonomy group is K of E10, or K of E9, if a little more modest. And what we see on these unfaithful representations is a mere shadow of this huge asymmetry group, if you like, or holonomy group. So it's a little bit like Plato, you know, with Plato, people sit in the caves, they see some shadows on the wall, but they have no way to access what's really there outside of the cave. So they simply go by the shadows they see. And what I'm saying here is that these holonomy groups that have been studied in the literature so far, they're just like mere shadows of the real thing. And we are like the cavemen sitting there and staring at those shadows. So here we are. These are the major challenges ahead, just as difficult as for E10. First of all, namely understand E10 via this hypothetical infinite tower of ever increasing unfaithful representations. We have recently made some progress on this, at least for K9, which is much easier. In this paper, we're able to show that actually we can demonstrate the existence of an infinite towers of such unfaithful representations. In fact, we even can provide a raison d'être for their existence. This is done by mapping the KE9 to a sort of parabolic structure. As I said, these associated quotient groups capture more and more, and you see here the ones for the representations that we found. You see this already quite big. And another strange feature is, although you're dealing with a compact group, actually this quotient group is non-compact. That's a strange fact. So, you see this, if you could understand this better, that would also help with E10, because once you know KE10, you also know E10, a lot of about it. And the idea is to sort of exhaust the algebra by ever increasing bigger and bigger and bigger chunks that capture more and more of this infinite structure while remaining infinitely degenerate at each stage. So you will never be able to catch everything. And no matter how far you go, there's still an infinite tower of root spaces that you cannot faithfully capture. But you can push, if this works, you would be able to push this as far as you like. And I think this is also important for the physics, because it's probably needed to see how K10 unfolds in the physics context to give rise to emergent space-time fermions. And once you understand that, maybe you will also be able to understand how space-time emerges on the bosonic side. Again, problem for the next 20 string conferences to worry about. Well, I'm not sure whether they worry about this at all at the moment, but I think this is the thing to look at. So, you know, as I said, we try to keep doing the things that we can do. So let's now go back to this, because this, I think, is interesting physics aspect. I told you about this strange coincidence that Gell-Mann exposed between standard model fermions and n equals 8 supergravity fermions. And let me repeat, there's this funny mismatch here. And, you know, in view of all the efforts that we've gone through with this, we're now convinced that there's just no way to fix this within n equals 8 supergravity, meaning to fix the Q and also to somehow undo this descent to the diagonal subgroup of family SU3 and SU3 Kala. So it's clear from that already that, you know, n equals 8 is not enough to match supergravity with the fermions. So now here comes the leap of faith. The way out that sort of is hinted at by all these considerations, we would like to interpret the fermionic degrees of freedom of n equals 8, the n equals 8 supermultiplet at a given spatial point, that's a strong restriction, as a special representation of K10. We no longer think of it as part of a supermultiplet, but we would like to think of it as a fermionic representation of this peculiar infinite dimensional group. So more specifically, the Rita-Schwinger representation, that's what we're looking at, that contains 8 gravitinos and 56 spin 1/2 fermions at one spatial point. And as I said, kinematically, it's still true, this counting, if you absorb 8 Goldsteinos into the gravitinos, and then you end up with 48 spin 1/2 fermions, corresponding to the 3 generations of 16 quarks and leptons. Let me emphasize again, this is mere kinematics. We have no idea how this could be dynamically realized. Nevertheless, you get an interesting prediction from this, which is falsifiable, namely that besides the 48 quarks, including right-handed neutrinos, the only other particles that this model, fermionic particles that this model predicts of this scheme, are the 8 massive gravitinos, which accompany the 48 spin 1/2 fermions. So, you know, we're easily done in if in the next 10 years somebody discovers a new truly fundamental spin 1/2 particle, then that's it, we're cooked. So I said it's not, cannot be cured within n equals 8 supergravity, but I looked at this and I thought for many years, I thought, well, that's it, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. But after, so 2015 or so, when this LHC results started coming out and more results came out and nothing turned up except standard model, Krzysztof Meissner and I sort of went back and said, asked ourselves, well, you know, what would it take to actually correct for this mismatch? Let's just start with electrical charges. That's the easier part. Let's just try to see what would it take to correct this, to how to deform the U1 action that such a way that it gives the correct has the correct action on the quarks and leptons. And amazingly, there's a sort of quite simple extension of, well, of the R symmetry of n equals 8 that does this. And so here, if you think about this SOA generator, which is just imaginary unit in some sense, certainly for the SU3 cross U1 subgroup that we have studied in connection with cage supergravity, the only thing you have to add is this funny triple product. So this is the usual co-product of SOA to act on a threefold antisymmetric representation. So here are the fermions. So the only thing you have to add is this T wedge T wedge T. This is clearly not an SO8 or SU8. So that proves again that we're not no longer within n equals 8 supergravity. So that's the first part. So what I want to show you now that it is actually in KE10. And furthermore, of course, we also need to extend the action of this Kalman spurion shift to the gravitinos. So here's the argument why this does belong to KE10. This was done in Schoner paper with Axel some 5 years ago. Maybe I shouldn't go in too much detail here, but we've done, you have to go back to the original Cramer-Gilliard analysis of how to get the n equals 8 fermions from 11 dimensions. There are certain redefinitions, which you see here. Many indices, I won't explain what they are because that's not really so. This would be a separate lecture, really. Anyway, one has to rewrite this in a little bit using these funny Damour-Hillman fermions, where you take the gravitinos and multiply them by a gamma matrix without summing over the spatial indices. So that breaks SO10 covariance. This is something Axel already showed you a week ago. So then you have these funny objects, and turns out that there's a very simple action of this thing on these in this Damour-Hillman basis. And this actually provides a realization on all fermions, including the gravitinos. So that's one of the things we wanted to do. Now, how do you show that it's in KE10? For this, we need this explicit formula of the action of a KE10 generator on this fermion in this funny basis. And this, remarkably, this is a formula that works for all real roots of E10, of which there are infinitely many. So if it was just the gamma matrix, it was very simple because there are only finite number of them. But here you have a rather large choice, and then you can put it on a computer and check whether linear combinations that give you exactly what you want. And this something you can do. And the important thing here is that in order to achieve this match, I cannot stay within finite dimensional R symmetries. It just doesn't work. I have to go all the way to infinite dimensions. In some sense, we haven't really written a proof of this, but it's obvious in this numerical construction that you have to go to very high height E10 roots in order to make this work. And you cannot provide this shift if you simply stay within E8, E7, or even K of E9. It's not enough. So this indicates, from my point of view, that actually in order to match standard model quantum numbers with whatever the unified symmetry is, you have to go all the way to infinite dimensional groups. I should also mention that once we have this, we can generalize this to the full set of quantum numbers of the standard model. Because this Q group which acts here is sufficiently large. This is at this point mere kinematics, so I cannot tell you why the theory should do this or what mechanism leads to this breaking. But there's one interesting little aspect here, which is the following, namely, if you look at this, Kalman assumed an SU3 family. And if you look at it, you realize it cannot commute with SU2 weak, which is, this is because the U and the D, which form the SU2 weak doublet, they get assigned to different representations of the family SU3. you know, we try to do it otherwise, but this seems to be the only way to get this to work. So it means, this is interesting because in the old days and times of gut theories, people tried to include family symmetries, making the groups even bigger. It didn't work in the end. But an assumption that always went into this was the family group commutes with the standard model group. And what we see here is that life is not so simple, whatever this means. So the big open questions for the next couple of years, or maybe decades, how does K10 unfold to give rise to spatial dependence that would really allow us to claim that this is really the standard model gauge group with bosonic, the vector bosons and all what have you. And other questions, of course, even if it's kinematically possible, how could you break this infinite dimensional symmetry to a gauge symmetry? So it's still infinite dimensional, but what would sort of bring it down to this? Difficult questions. And this is why, again, we move in some direction where we can think that we can say something. So maybe I should stop here for questions.